Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. Our culture seeks to eliminate Christianity by assimilating Christians into the social and moral values of society. Nowhere is this assimilation more obvious than in the world of higher education. The pressure to look good in the academic world pressures students to minimize their faith in God. Professors tell a smart Oxford University student, for example, to abandon her Christian worldview if she wants to get ahead in her scientific career. The new atheists call themselves the brights, implying that all theists are dull and dim-witted. We live in a pagan world. I do not mean by pagan the occult or shamanism. I mean by paganism an anti-God worldview. Polytheism is acceptable because it does not advocate for one God. Historians call this period of American history postmodernism. Postmodernism relativizes absolute truth and absolutizes relative values. There is no absolute truth, except that there is no absolute truth. Everybody's truth is equally true, no matter how contradictory, and tolerance is the highest value. All religious ideas and all personal values must be accepted. There is incredible social pressure to conform to this thinking throughout our educational system in America today. Daniel dealt with similar pressures in his day, and we can learn from Daniel 1, verses 3 to 13, that the pressures of a pagan education require a strategy for personal resistance. Now, we must not withdraw into our comfortable Christian cocoons, but neither should we lash out in rage against the world system in which we live. The pressures of a pagan education require a strategy for personal resistance. We need to be smart about our responses to this world so that we can be winsome witnesses for Christ. Daniel provides an excellent model for us to follow. Look with me at Daniel chapter 1, verses 3 through 7, where we learn that assimilation is the goal of a pagan education. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now, among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah, Shadrach, to Mishael, Meshach, and to Azariah, Abednego. "We are the Borg. We will assimilate you. Resistance is futile." The Borg are a highly developed race of predators in the Star Trek television series. The Borg do not coexist with anyone. They simply assimilate all other beings into the collective, the hive, a single entity in which all individual thinking and personality are lost. Well, our culture has a strategy of assimilation. Get everyone to conform to a collective mindset so that we all will be assimilated into one collective entity. Daniel and his three friends faced that same pressure when they enrolled at the University of Babylon. The first principle of assimilation is start early with the best and the brightest. Start early with the best and the brightest. Nebuchadnezzar's strategy was to get them young. He picked the best and the brightest to bring into his educational system for assimilation. Daniel and his friends were probably about 15 or 16 years old when taken to Babylon. Some scholars believe that Ashpenaz, the chief official for Nebuchadnezzar, may have accompanied him on his military campaigns and selected young men for the Royal Academy. Ashpenaz was like the chief of staff to Nebuchadnezzar and was responsible for the royal family and the king's harem. Notice the standards for selection. They had to be handsome and well respected by their peers. They would have been already well educated in the royal palace in Jerusalem and the best students in their city. These men were the valedictorians of their high schools. The ultimate standard was that they were men who had ability for serving in the king's court. In other words, they would be academically and physically capable of taking high government positions once they were trained. These would be the Rhodes Scholars of their day. The strategy for assimilation was to start early with the best and the brightest. Then the Babylonians sought to establish an environment for assimilation in verses 4 through 7. These young men were immersed in the social values of Babylon. The academy would be a three-year program of assimilation. They would eat the king's food and enjoy the king's wine. They would be taught the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So we see here some clues about their education. The language of the Chaldeans was Akkadian, a highly complex writing system. But they also must have learned Sumerian, because much of the ancient literature of that world was written in Sumerian. They would have learned these languages, perhaps others, in addition to Hebrew and Aramaic. We know from archaeology that the Sumerians were highly educated. Daniel and his friends would have been immersed in the study of history, poetry, astronomy, mathematics, economics, and religious mythology. The term Chaldean, as opposed to Babylonian, is probably significant. It is true that the word could be just a word to describe that geographical region, but most likely it is used in its technical sense. Technically, the term described a group of elite scholars who studied the magical arts of the ancient world, including astrology. These were the Chaldeans. Daniel and his friends were taught the practice of divination, astrology, omens, and magical incantations. Divination meant that they would have learned how to make decisions based upon dreams and visions, as well as reading the signs from the livers of sheep. In order to make their assimilation complete, they were given new names. Daniel, which means God is my judge, was changed to Belteshazzar, which means may a goddess protect the king. Hananiah, which means Yahweh shows grace, becomes Shadrach, which means command of Aku, the moon god. Mishael means who is like God. And that was changed to Meshach, meaning who is like Aku. Azariah means the Lord is my help. That's changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nego, a pagan deity. They were all renamed as pagans, serving pagan gods and goddesses. The strategy was to establish an environment for assimilation. Daniel and his three friends were to spend 3 years studying at the University of Babylon. Were they compromising their faith by taking pagan names and studying pagan courses? No. The prophet Jeremiah had written a letter to these exiles from Jerusalem, and in that letter he told them that God had placed them there and they should work hard to be successful in Babylon. In the middle of that letter, Jeremiah wrote these words in Jeremiah 29, verse 7. Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile. That's Babylon. Seek the welfare of Babylon and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare. John Lennox writes, Jeremiah's message is still valid for us as we face the encroaching Babylon of our day. Indeed, these words can be an immense support to young people leaving a Christian home to go to a university. As ambassadors for our heavenly King, we are encouraged to seek the welfare of the city, first in the university and then in the wider world. Be the best you can be. Work hard. Achieve success for the city where you live, for the corporation you work for. But don't forget the city you ultimately represent, and that is the heavenly Jerusalem. We are where we are by divine direction. God has placed you in this world to represent Him while seeking the welfare of the place you live and work. However, don't succumb to the doctrine of tolerance to be successful. Now that's the trick, isn't it? We should achieve success without losing our identity as followers of Christ. Josh McDowell and Bob Hostetler wrote a book quite a few years ago now entitled The New Tolerance. They raised a warning without being alarmist and suggested many ways that we can counteract the culture we live in by a winsome Christian testimony. In that book, Josh identifies the primary value of our culture today as tolerance. He tells about his son, Sean, who was a senior in high school at the time. He asked him, "Sean, in 12 years of school, were you ever taught any absolute truth?" "Sure," his son responded. "Tolerance." Now, we must understand that the word tolerance does not mean respectfully disagreeing with others. It means you must accept what they do and believe it as truth, or else you are intolerant. You must accept it. If you disagree with the icons of our culture, then you are violating the value of tolerance. This is the dominant strategy for assimilation in our culture. Leslie Armour, a philosophy professor at the University of Ottawa, proposed Our idea is that to be a virtuous citizen is to be one who tolerates everything except intolerance. The doctrine of tolerance means that we can make no moral judgments about anything without becoming intolerant. Our culture says, "We're the Borg. We will assimilate you." It's the strategy of higher education. What can we do? We can follow Daniel's example. That's what we can do. In verses 8 through 13, we see Daniel's example, and he is a model for us. Our response to assimilation determines our influence on our culture, verses 8 through 13. Our response to assimilation determines our influence on our culture, how we respond. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king." But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence, and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see." Some might suggest that the best approach is to pull back and isolate ourselves in our Christian ghettos. After all, if even the government is antagonistic to our faith, what can we possibly hope to accomplish? Not Daniel, and we would do well to follow his example. We need what I call a countercultural strategy. And there are 4 parts to that countercultural strategy that we can see in verses 8 through 13. First, pick your protest, verse 8. Pick your protest. A countercultural strategy always begins with a personal decision, a conviction, to make a stand for God. This is exactly what Daniel decided to do, given the circumstances in which he lived. Up to this point, there's no record of any resistance on the part of Daniel. Now, he resists. Why? Why did Daniel choose this battle while offering no resistance to the name changes honoring pagan gods or to the study of magical arts, astrology, and divination? Part of the answer, certainly, is that the study of something does not mean agreement. You can study a subject antagonistic to Christianity without agreeing with it. However, we need to dig deeper into the question, because the answer to that question will help us immensely in our development of a strategy for resistance in our world. I have seen several common explanations for this decision by Daniel. First, the dietary laws of the Old Testament forbade Daniel from eating ritually unclean food. So Daniel followed God by refusing to defile himself with food that was outside the dietary regulations of the law. If that is the answer, then why did he protest over the wine? No laws forbid Daniel from drinking wine unless he had taken a Nazarite vow. And why were dietary laws more important than laws governing idolatry or divination? According to Leviticus 11, Daniel would have been free to eat many kinds of meat, including lamb, beef, fish, and chicken. Furthermore, Daniel would have been rendered ritually unclean by his very presence in Babylon, so everything he ate would have been ritually unclean. The second argument is that these foods would have been offered to idols, and thus Daniel would have implicated himself in idol worship by eating the food. Well, if that was the case, how could he eat any food from the king? Even grain or vegetables could have been offered to the idols. The third argument is that by eating the king's food, he would have been entering into a covenant of loyalty with the king. Now, this is better, but it still raises troubling questions. He ate vegetables from the king, so why not meat? The final problem with all of these explanations is that his conviction appears to have been temporary. Later, in Daniel chapter 10, verse 3, it seems to be his usual habit to eat meat and drink wine like everyone else, because he stops eating meat or wine for a 3-week fast in Daniel 10. I think the key is the way this subject is introduced. Daniel made up his mind. Another translation reads, he purposed in his heart. This is no public protest. The king probably never even knew about it. This is a personal, private decision. Personal convictions are not biblical mandates for everyone else. The best explanation is that Daniel picked an area on which to make a stand as a test of faith, and his friends joined him. He wanted to know that their success would not be the result of the favors of this pagan king, but because God had given them success. He was making a faith statement here that was personal and profound. If they were successful, it would be because of God's power. The king would never know, but they would know and give God the glory. So instead of trying to force the government to change, Daniel sought to influence relationships that he had within the government. The result was that he influenced the government of a pagan country through those relationships. Daniel was in a compromising situation. A Christian in a pagan environment should pick his protest carefully. There are all kinds of things to protest, and many you could do nothing about. Find an area where you can make a difference and put your faith in God to the test so that you can give him the glory and not the school, not the technology when you are successful. That is why I say, pick your protest. Decide what hill to plant your flag on and where you will choose to make a stand. And then, secondly, trust God to prepare your path. Trust God to prepare your path, verse 9. Back in Jerusalem, the prophet Jeremiah was prophesying, and he talked about two baskets of figs. One basket had good figs, and the other basket had bad figs. God told the people through Jeremiah that the bad figs were the people in Israel who fought against the pagan rule of Babylon. The good figs were Daniel and his friends. The bad figs were the public protesters. The good figs were the private influencers. Jeremiah wrote in Jeremiah 24, verse 5, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, like these good figs, so I will regard as good the captives of Judah, whom I have sent out of this place into the land of the Chaldeans." Daniel knew from the prophet Jeremiah that he was in Babylon by God's appointment. God has him where God wants him to be. And so it is with you and me, my friends. If we are obeying God, then God places us where he wants us. And we can trust God to prepare our path, which allows us to live in peace with those around us, even as we resist the assimilation of those against us. Daniel does not bomb the palace or picket the Royal Academy. He quietly goes to the chief of staff and explains his conviction. But you see, God was already at work in this pagan's heart. Not that the man was prepared to follow Daniel's God, but God had softened his heart toward Daniel. A relationship had developed where this high official had a soft spot for Daniel. Imagine, out of the dozens, perhaps even hundreds of men from various conquered countries, this man had already come to think highly of Daniel. Now, that doesn't happen by accident. The verse tells us that God had been at work in this man's heart already, so he reacted kindly toward Daniel and his request. So as you pick your protest, remember that God is preparing the way in advance for you to express your faith in him. Third, respect the feeling of others. Respect the feelings of others, verses 10 and 11. Now, this powerful official could have simply refused to listen to Daniel or even punished him for bringing up the subject at all. Instead, the man explains his problem to Daniel. The powerful political official's problem is that if he allows Daniel to disobey the orders of the king, then he places himself in a risky situation. If Daniel and his friends are questioned, then the king could become angry with this official and even kill him. He could lose his head. Now, this was hardly an idle threat in a culture where life was cheap and people were routinely executed on the whims of the king. What I find striking here is that Daniel listened with respect. He does not protest publicly. He does not even argue his case. Daniel does not put this political leader in a difficult spot. The chief of staff did not tell him he could not do this. He just basically said, "Don't get me involved." So, Daniel does not get him involved. He goes to someone closer to the situation, a steward. This man, the steward, would have been the one who actually handed out the food. He was a servant who probably didn't eat this well himself. Daniel makes a deal with the steward. "Supply me with the food I request for 10 days, and then we will evaluate the situation." The steward, of course, probably got to keep the sumptuous royal fare for himself, so, hey, why not try it for 10 days? You see, there's more than one way to take a stand. Notice Daniel's strategy. It's not a frontal assault, but a private test of his own faith. He is sensitive to the needs of the pagan official. I think we need to remember that many times we are in situations where our protest can harm others, and we need to respect their fears. We need to value people enough to look for ways that we can express our faith without destroying their lives. My guess is that Daniel had many opportunities later to share his faith with these men because he had earned that right by how he handled this matter. Our tendency is to put the risk on others instead of taking the risk ourselves. If this is our faith that we are putting on the line, then we should risk our lives, not the lives of others, even if they are pagan lives. People will respect the reality of our faith more for that simple reason, and we will earn the right to be heard by them later. The fourth element of our countercultural strategy is submit your faith to be tested in verses 12 and 13. Submit your faith to be tested. Look at what Daniel says in these verses. He offers a test where he takes all the risk. He says, "Prove your servants, and then when it is over, deal with your servants." "It's all in your hands," Daniel says. I will submit my faith to your test. Let me eat what I ask for 10 days and then test the theory. If you are not satisfied, then do with us what you want. If we really believe that God is sovereign, my friends, and his ways are true, then we can take a stand on the moral and social issues of our day without fear. We can calmly stand for God's truth and respectfully resist the icons of our culture. Students, don't be afraid to put your faith to the test. Talk with the professor. Offer to do extra work to present your faith. If the teacher doesn't like it, then take whatever grade he or she thinks it's worth. Put your faith to the test and accept the consequences. Now, for Daniel, this is a small area, but he's only 15 or 16 years old. Later, the stakes will be much greater. This moment is preparing him for those higher stakes to come later in his life. He learns that he can trust God when he puts his faith on the line. And so can you, my friends. So can you. One time, Madeline Murray O'Hare, the famous atheist, was asked why so many people seem to be afraid of her. "I'll tell you why so many Christians are," she replied. "They are not sure what they say they believe is true. If they were, I wouldn't be a threat to them at all." She's right. Now, I don't want to imply that God will always keep you from the consequences. Sometimes when we study heroes like Daniel, we assume that God always answers in this way, but that's not the case, for then there would be no risk at all. And there is risk when you stand for Christ. You may risk your degree. You may risk your grade. You may risk that promotion at work. Take a stand anyway. Pick your protest. Trust God to prepare your path. Respect the feelings of others. And submit your faith to be tested. That is a countercultural strategy for Christians. Josh McDowell and Bob Hostetler argue that we should adopt a simple strategy in life. Aggressively love others and humbly take a stand for truth. The adverbs must not be reversed if we are to follow Daniel's countercultural strategy. Many times we see Christians who aggressively take a stand for truth and humbly love others. McDowell says it ought to be the opposite. We must aggressively love others, regardless of their values, their beliefs, or their behaviors. We should be known first for our love. Then we should humbly stand for truth. We should speak the truth while acknowledging our own failings. Start from the platform of humility and not arrogance. We have the truth. We don't need to jam it down the throats of pagans, and we surely have our own failings that we need to be honest about. So here are a couple of practical suggestions for universities, students, and you can add your own to these. First, write the paper or answer the question so well that you get an A. Then privately express your faith and why you disagree with the answer you've given for the test. Second, negotiate alternatives on assignments and propose something twice as hard. Don't take the easy way out. Daniel didn't. Make it twice as hard and do the work twice as well. This earns you the right to express your faith. If you are in the corporate world, be the best employee you can be. Strive for excellence in everything you do. As Jeremiah told Daniel, seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you. Seek the prosperity and success of the company where you work. Achieve the highest ratings and accomplish much for the company you serve. Invest yourself fully in making the company profitable so that your bosses can count on you to make them look good. This earns you the right to express your faith. However, my friends, don't compromise your faith to look good or to gain favors. There are times to take a stand, but when you take a stand, make sure it is about God and not about yourself. Don't be afraid to let God be tried and tested in this world. God can handle it. Don't worry about Him.